Hello.
Hey.
you're excited.
No, I was just trying to start with some enthusiasm because I felt like I start every episode with the fact that I'm like tired and I say hello. And yeah. That probably gets old eventually. And I know in short order I will sound like that, but I figured, you know, start with some false enthusiasm.
Yeah, you know, ramp down from expectations, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You start at a high point and then, you know, it's all downhill because it's, you know, makes it easier.
Yeah, they call it falling action.
They call it tumbling down a hill.
Okay.
I am becoming more clumsy as I get older.
Hopefully you're not tumbling down hills.
No, I broke a coffee mug today, I think for the first time.
Oh.
Yeah.
What was the occasion?
I was making coffee, as I do, and I do the inverted AeroPress method, and something that has happened on, I don't know, probably three or four occasions is that the AeroPress is full of grounds and potentially even water, and I kind of bump it, and it starts, like, wobbling because it's, you know, tall and thin, and I have to catch it so it doesn't fall over, and sometimes I catch it, and it spills coffee all over the place, but this time I caught it. Before the grounds went everywhere, but in my catching it, my elbow knocked the mug off of the counter and it went flying and splattered everywhere.
Well, it's another ringing endorsement for the AeroPress.
I think it has more to do with my particular setup because everything has to be in exactly the same. I'm very Howard Hughes about my setup. Like, everything has to be in the exact same place every single day, every single time. In a very specific order, and I tap things a certain number of times. It's very weird. I hope nobody ever has to see me do it.
Do you need to see a doctor about this?
What makes you think I already don't?
Oh, okay. Just checking.
You know, the coffee's still good, so it's fine.
Oh,
it's working.
Well, I mean, that's the important part. You know,
I get my caffeine.
People like to have a ritual. It's good to have a ritual.
It's something I can do when my brain is not yet fully awake.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I got, I have a gooseneck kettle and a pour over thing, and I do that, but then sometimes I forget to grind the coffee and I don't want to wake up my neighbors in the morning, and then I'm just, it's so sad, and I'm just like...
You forget to grind the coffee, you grind it the night before or something?
Well, ideally, you would do the grinding sometime after 9 in the morning, you shouldn't really. The walls here are paper thin, so maybe 8:30-ish or something. But I don't really like to. You know, if I wake up at 6:30, then some people downstairs might be upset if I were to just, like, you know, rip the whole place apart with the sound vibrations of the little blade spinner inside the Capresso garbage.
First of all, you gotta stop that thing. I was just gonna say, like, I think it takes maybe 15 seconds max to, and I use a lot of beans per cup of coffee, so I think by the time anybody's sort of like stirred from their sleep to see what the hell was going on, the sound would be done, and then they'd be like, what was that? And they would just go back to sleep.
Yeah.
But if you got one of them spinny blade duty mabob thingy mabobs, it might just take longer to get an appropriate grind.
Yeah, I've also noticed Jason has a Krupps one. You've seen the Krupps one.
Have I?
Yeah, it's the sort of squashed cylinder with a diagonal.
That's the one that everyone uses to grind spices on all the cooking shows, right?
Yes, exactly. That is exactly the model.
Those are very bad grinders.
Well, they're not. It's not fantastic, but it's so much better than the Capresso. Just to give you an idea of how bad this particular one is. But at the same time, every time I look at the cost of a burr grinder, I'm just like, I can't
you
do it.
You have this one. Is it the one that's shaped like a burr grinder, but it's not?
No.
Yours is shaped like a little cylinder guy, too.
Yeah, well, except it's roundy. It's
it's silver and it's $21
no,
from Bed Bath & Beyond.
It's black plastic, and I think it probably was around that price.
Oh, there you go. There's a black version. So it's a cylinder.
It's sort of roundish on the sides, not a straight up and down cylinder.
And like the button goes down the whole side of the front of it, kind of. Yeah, I mean, there's a Krupps one here that looks very similar to it as well, but... they're all the same sort of thing, but no. This Cuisinart one, I have this one, which was a It looks like a burr grinder, but it's really just two little metal plates that squish stuff. Yeah. It's not that good.
I know that the blade grinder is not as good as a burr grinder. I know that. I know all the science. I know that the blade grinder is chopping up pieces into various sizes, and so you don't get a good pour, blah, 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 blah. The heat generated from the blade, etc. I don't know. Whatever. I know all this crap. It's just, you look at the price tag, and then you say, am I going to care? And it turns out I don't. I just don't like running the little blade grinder thingy with its high-pitched, loud motor thing.
I feel confident in saying that once you get one of the real burr grinders, you will wonder how you ever lived without it, and you will say, I was an animal.
Yeah. Also, I don't have a ton of counter space. Imagine,
they're really not that much wider than the little squat guy, your normal doodad.
No, but I don't have like a setup spot for it, is what I'm saying.
Oh, you're mobile grinding.
Well, this little thing, it has a little cord that wraps around the bottom, helpfully, and then you can put it on top of the fridge, and you don't have to worry about it.
Well, most of the burr grinders are a little heavy for that kind of thing.
Yeah, but... yeah. So,
well, if it's so small, why don't you get a cheap pillow that you don't like and wrap it around there when you're grinding?
It sounds like a perfectly good plan. Anyway, this is a long way of saying that I understand the ritual of making the coffee, but then as I was doing it on several occasions, I'm like, if I have the time, I feel like this is, you know, a good way to like meditate and de-stress, that you're like watching the little timer thing and pouring at a certain rate, and it's all great, you know, the gooseneck kettle doing its gooseneck action. But then on occasions I'm a little rushed, and so it doesn't feel relaxing. It feels like, oh God, why don't I just plug in the Mr. Coffee and just be done with it? Because then I can take my shower while it's brewing in its horrible little pot where it's burning on the bottom from the heating element. That just seems so much more efficient. But I really do prefer the pour over. I wanted to stress that. I like the pour over. It's really great. And
Does want to know why you hate yourself.
Well, I mean, there's too many reasons.
I told him it's because you're from Florida, but you know.
Yes. But there's a beautiful pour over set that I have. I was gifted for Christmas, and it's gorgeous, and I love it. It's the Kalita. Not the wave, which is the traditional one that you'll see if you Google it immediately, which I know you're doing. But there's
stainless one.
No, not the metal one. There's another one that's just glass, with a little black disc basically underneath it. And then there's sort of a what looks like an Earl Meyer flask kind of.
There's a solid white one. There's a clear glass one with like a black little flange on it.
Yes, that's,
and then there's the metal guy,
the clear one. With the straight sides.
This one does not have straight sides. This is tilty sides.
Well, so tilted but straight. What they're known for is the Kalita wave, which is like a wavy side.
Oh, so the wavy side is supposed to influence the penetration of the water in some way?
Sure. But I don't like the look of that one, so I don't have the wave.
This one's called the wave, but it's also clear glass. I'm so confused.
It's clear glass, but it's straight. Well, not straight, but a tilted downward angle.
It's a trapezoid from a perpendicular view.
Yeah, yeah. From a certain point of view. And so then there's the flask little thing, and then it sits on top of a scale. It all functions very well. It all does its thing. Oh, wait, what do you mean I'm a scale boy? You have to have a scale for pour over.
Do you?
Well,
I don't do pour overs.
Well, you kind of do, because otherwise you're going to wind up pouring either too much water or too little water. Because
here's the thing. I fill it up to the top, and I have my bean measurements by scoop, so it's always the same ratio.
Yeah, but what I'm describing is a different method of brewing coffee.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I've never done a pour-over. And this is also why I don't do regular AeroPress, because you kind of get into the pour-over thing where it starts seeping through before you're done filling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can't... You can't just like expect that the amount of liquid you have put in is the appropriate amount, because it's draining out the bottom. And you also can't gauge the amount of liquid that's in the bottom, because you don't know how much is going to keep coming out of the grounds, because it's dripping. It's a process. And it's essential that it drips, because if you just let it sit in it, that like if you were brewing tea, then you get a different flavor thingy or some garbage. I don't know. I just make the coffee, Dan. I just make the coffee and I drink the coffee and the coffee's good. The pour over coffee tastes delicious, and I love the aesthetic of the little thing, and I pour it over into my Bauer mugs with the little hive honeycomb. Well, not honeycomb, but they like a beehive shape, or I pour it into the Le Creuset ones that you gave me. They're both the same color, by the way. But it just depends on my mood, which one I grab.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, beehive coffee mug. Huh? Is it this orange color?
No,
not the same color. You're saying same color.
It's the tealish one, whatever the technical term for that is. Something blue.
This is an interesting looking mug here.
It's a good mug.
They have French blue and they have aqua. I assume you have French blue.
It's aqua.
Oh, you have the more vibrant one.
Yes. It really does match the Le Creuset. I don't know what the photo on the website is that you were looking at, but it matches the Le Creuset in tone. And the Le Creuset I'm referring to is the Caribbean blue Le Creuset, which also matches my Dutch oven, which is important.
Probably gets a lot of use, doesn't it?
Not so much. I don't cook a lot at home. Jason's cooking with his Dutch oven, and that one is the white Le Creuset, or he has the Staub that I bought him for Christmas, which is like, I don't know how to describe it, like eggplant colored. It's dark and purple. And then on the inside, it's that Staub thing of it being like cast iron that you need to take care of, as opposed to what I prefer, the enameled finish of the Le Creuset.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, this
I think
is
the mug that I broke was from Target. I liked it because I do an Americana style thing, so the size of the mug is very important because I want to top it off with some hot water, but I don't want it to be too full or too empty, but at the same time I want to balance the ratio of the actual coffee with the water. And these ones, I have two of them, I have one now, and it was the perfect size for like a 1-to-1 Americano.
Do they still sell it? I know that Target has some rotating inventory, so you may have a problem.
Yeah, I have some other Target ones that are very ugly. I should throw away, but
that's one of those difficult things about mugs. No matter how ugly they are, or what novelty gift they are that you've received, they. You don't want to get rid of them.
We have so many mugs. How many mugs do you have? We have so many mugs. It's embarrassing.
I don't have that many. I think I probably have like 6 or 7 here. And then over at Jason's place, he's the one who has a lot of mugs. Mm. And so there are multiple sets of things. And there are some that are hand wash only mugs. Can you imagine? Oh.
I can't imagine. I have some old... I have like 5 of them. They're hilariously minuscule, like they're coffee mugs for, I don't know, people from the 50s when everything was smaller or something. But they are from ACP Tour, the tennis brand, back when ATP Tour was new, because my dad was part of that company that started that whole thing.
ATP Tour?
Yes.
Like Accidental Tech Podcast?
The American Tennis Pros, I think, is the name of it.
Oh.
But the ATP Tour is now a tour for... yes, it is a tennis tournament, but in the beginning it was a competing brand of tennis ball and other products, and there was some fun like industrial sabotage, which is the reason it collapsed. But anyway, I have some mugs from them, and they're like black, like shiny black with like gold leaf logo on them, and I don't want to ruin them, but at the same time I'm not going to like hand wash all 8 of them or whatever. Like some of them will just get used more often than others.
Did I ever tell you that you say tour weird?
You say that I say a lot of words weird.
Mm-hmm. Tour.
Which podcast was I just listening to? Which one of our episodes where you kept saying I was saying a word weird?
I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Well, it's my desert accent. Also, I'm very tired.
Tour. All right. So, I don't have that many mugs, and the ones that Jason has are normal size. They're not like teeny tiny or anything. But they're just hand wash only because they're like Japanese ceramic ones, and then that's not even getting
on there.
Yeah, that's not even getting into the set that we've never used, which is the like there when we were in Venice a couple years ago now, I think. The Jason had shipped to him a set of I guess technically teacups and saucers, and the interior of it is shiny gold. Not gold leaf, shiny gold. I don't know how they do it, but I assume they just coat the interior of it with gold that's melted, and then they just don't do that anymore. And wow. So I think I'm terrified to use them. So I'm glad he hasn't recommended that we give that a shot yet, but they're in a cabinet somewhere. It's not a crime to like pretty things. Just want to put that out there in the world that it's okay. But at the same time, you wind up with a lot of mugs if you just like pretty things.
So how many mugs would you say are in regular rotation?
At my place, I would say there's four. Two, like we're saying, two of the Bauer Pottery ones. And the Bauer Pottery ones I have are seconds from the seconds sale that they do on site at the Bauer Pottery location.
Okay.
I don't even have good ones. I have ones that are considered inferior to sell.
Well, they're $32 a piece. So.
Well, yeah, and so I got them for like $20. So I fully appreciate the discount that I received. But as well as my Dutch oven is also a second that you can get from the Le Creuset outlet. Jason got this one for me from I think the Cabazon outlet out there on your way to Ventura. It was like $99 or something at the time, I think, as opposed to like $160, I think, would normally cost for this one. But I don't mind it being a second, and I can see the imperfection, and it doesn't bother me in the slightest. I consider the overall beauty of the product to be worth it. So I understand why there's an industry that sells seconds. I don't think you will find that for your Target mug, unfortunately.
No, probably not.
Yeah,
it's plain white.
Oh, well, I mean that's an aesthetic. That's very minimalist. Just,
it's a terrible looking mug, but it's the perfect ratio of coffee to water for the way I make stuff.
Oh, why was it poorly shaped in some way?
No, it's just it's I don't know. The standard like straight sides coffee mug is too small for the way I like to make coffee. And then you get the ones that sort of like bulge out in a different way. And some of those are too large. We found one coffee mug buried in the back of one of my dad's cabinets that was one of those like comically large like Friends 90s coffee mugs, which it's legitimately a soup bowl with a handle on it. It's so big.
Oh, man.
And at this point, it just gets used for like ice cream or something or reheating things. But it just happened to be the right amount of bulging out on the sides and fitting the right amount of coffee for me. But as a result, it is narrower in the bottom than it is at the top. So that's kind of why it tips over easy when your elbow comes flying in.
Yeah. Jason has some weirdly shaped ones that we don't really use unless we haven't run the dishwasher at his place in a second. Because there are some that he has that have like a really narrow base and then it like goes up towards the top and then flares way out. And so it's like this seems precarious. Like you put liquid in it and it's like hot liquid and it wants to like slosh around more at the top because there's a wider surface area. But at the base, it's narrower. So it always feels like, you know, it might tip over and then you might like scald yourself. That one don't use so much. And there's also one that has like a bear on the side of it, like a 3D like bear thing that's like, I don't know, glued or whatever on the side of it. It's some sort of novelty mug that he has.
I have one that has from Great Bear Coffee in Los Gatos, California. Shout out, good coffee. But it's like the Waffle House mug. It's got this really like adorable bear on the side holding up a coffee mug, but it's those super thick ceramic ones where you can get like one finger through the loop because it's so heavy and like just overly thick. And then the inside, it holds like half of a cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's a problem. Also, Jason has one from like a former job where the label was, I don't know how to say this, printed after it was glazed in some way, like it was adhered to it afterwards. And so if it goes through the dishwasher, it actually gets tacky from the heat of the dishwasher and like bits of it come off. And I'm like, this can't be good. Like that's not a good thing.
Ideal, no.
Yeah, because it says dishwasher safe on the bottom, but I'm sure the original mug was probably dishwasher safe, and then whatever disreputable company is like printing onto the side of the mug, that can't be. But that's neither here nor there, because I can't think of any way to segue this from our coffee and mug talk to get shorty. But
Do you think Chili Palmer drinks?
I don't know. We don't see him drink any coffee, do we?
No, we don't. But
he smokes a lot of cigarettes, though.
I feel like he's an espresso man.
Oh, I don't know. I think he's probably, if I were to guess, I would assume that he's somebody who takes his coffee black.
Yeah, or maybe once he gets out to LA, maybe a cappuccino man.
Well, I mean, that was the style at the time, especially the Ivy. You know, go roll up into the Ivy and order yourself a cappuccino.
It's a real place. I'm given to understand.
I've walked past it on occasions. I've never deigned to dine, but if I
is
do,
it expensive.
It's incredibly overpriced because it is known as a place where you will see celebrities, and
I would go for that.
Yeah, most of the time you don't see any celebrities, and then the other 2% of the time, you might see like some reality star, quote unquote, celebrity kind of person. So, yeah.
Well, you know, it's worth it every now and then.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not the kind of thing that I've partaken in. Oh, your threshold mug that you just sent me. The porcelain
coupe. It looks basically like that. The ones that I had are a little more narrow at the bottom, and the handle is a little bit smaller. But yeah, $2.69. Like, I should go, you know, pick some up.
Yeah. That's.
But you see what I'm saying? Like, it's not just like your standard issue straight up coffee mug. It's a little bit bulged out. So this one says it's 14 ounces, which I feel like is an uncommon coffee cup size.
Yeah, I think they're usually 12.
Yeah.
If I were to guess. But I don't know if Chili Palmer would approve. You know,
yeah,
he seems like somebody who likes things a certain way and expects just like the normal stuff that everybody else has to play out.
He's a fan of black clothing and black suits and black leather jackets,
which is an interesting style for Miami.
well, you know, when it's cold and rainy in Miami, it works, which I'm sure is very often.
Also, Miami, air quotes. This movie starts with a scene that takes place in Miami, and it's sort of Goodfellas diner-esque, I guess you could say, where one character is recounting to another character a tale, and we get long shots of people sitting at a table. But it is not Miami. They're in Los Angeles. And much later on, when they're driving on what I think is supposed to be Ocean Drive in South Beach, it is very clearly like whatever it is in Santa Monica, and it's one of those Art Deco hotels that's on Santa Monica that is similar enough to an Art Deco hotel that would be in South Beach, but there is a cliff and a fence that keeps you from going over the cliff. In the ones in Santa Monica, which you can very clearly see.
You gotta save money. It's a $30 million movie. So this, you had never seen this movie before, is that correct?
Oh, this is correct. I can confidently say I've never seen this movie.
Did you have any preconceived idea of what it was?
I thought it was a gangster mob movie, but I think I have parts of what I thought this was confused with what I thought Casino was.
Oh, that would be a bit of a mix-up there.
Yeah. For some reason, I feel like they didn't come out that many years apart from one another. And one has Joe Pesci and the other one has Danny DeVito. So you can
understand. They're in the same year.
Yeah, you can understand how I'd make a mistake, maybe.
Because Danny DeVito and Joe Pesci are the same person.
They're close enough. Squint.
Totally. But this is also more or less your first time viewing one of the more popular Elmore Leonard crimey type movies. Is that correct? Well, you've seen Jackie Brown, haven't you?
I have not.
You've not seen Jackie. Okay, so you haven't seen Jackie Brown, you haven't seen Out of Sight, and you hadn't seen Get Shorty. So those are the three big ones, apparently, for Elmore Leonard in terms of film adaptations of his books.
Right. I read that on Wikipedia later. I don't have anything against Elmore Leonard or his writing or anything or his career or you know, Foxy Brown or any of that stuff, but I just hadn't for whatever reason.
Well, for shame.
Yeah, well, I don't think I was old enough to have watched it at the time, and then it didn't seem to be popular with my friend group in college when we were revisiting older
movies.
No, definitely
not. It doesn't really, it's not exactly timeless, but it's funny that you say you weren't old enough to see it at the time, because I have a distinct memory of seeing this on HBO in a hotel with my parents while we were on a trip somewhere. And at some point in the movie, they were just like, I think you should go to bed now. But we were all up late and it was just like, we can't sleep. And I just hopped in the bed to watch TV with them for a little while. And this was what they were watching on HBO. And I was like, this is weird and adult and I'm uncomfortable.
Was it the sex or was it the use of profanity and slang that would be used to denigrate another class or group of people?
I feel like it was all of the above in my like groggy 11-year-old mind, just trying to take all this in at like 11 o'clock at night in some random hotel somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say, this might be scarring for a child. So it's a good thing.
No,
your
know
parents
what was scarring
turned
for a child is I saw Time Cop when it was new, and that was real bad. There's some stuff in there that a child shouldn't have seen.
I saw RoboCop when I was a kid because I saw the TV edited version and that there was a TV show for kids and well, not for kids, but a TV show that would air during the day. Like it was not adult in any way. There was a RoboCop TV show that was like really cheesy. There was like a hologram that he would talk to and stuff. It was not good. But the existence of those things, of an edited down version that I didn't know was edited down, and a TV show that was supposed to be broadly appealing, let's say, led me to ask my mom to rent RoboCop from Blockbuster for my birthday party. And
did you watch it in a room full of people?
Yeah, in a room full of other kids. We're watching RoboCop, and then it gets to the Ed 209 scene, and we're like, what?
Oh boy!
So oopsie daisy. I feel like my mom maybe could have read the R rating on that one, but it was R, right? I don't think it was PG-13, but I think it was not appropriate. We were probably like 10 or 11 or something when we watched that. That was poorly timed. But I understand the whole thing of seeing something that scars you. What I don't understand is why like Pee-wee's Big Adventure had Large Marge, or why anyone would let me watch Poltergeist with the clowns, or why I'd be flipping through channels and then I would see Tim Curry as a clown come up through the floor of a shower.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, there are lots of ways to scare children. I don't know if I really would have considered Get Shorty as one of them, but I guess I do now.
It's not that it was particularly like scarring. It's just that I have a very specific like sense memory of the layout of this hotel and like what it looked like and the size of the TV and everything. And the only reason that I have memories that specific is because of trauma.
Yeah, I understand and empathize with that, but. As an adult, I think you would survive. Fortunately,
yes, and I like this movie, and it's worth mentioning. Jackie Brown, good movie. Different movie from Tarantino's other movies, but a good movie.
Oh,
and,
I think I said Foxy Brown. Why did I say Foxy Brown? That's
what they're referencing. And Pam Grier, I believe, was in that as well.
That's
a character, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I should Google this before I say something stupid. Foxy Brown is also the name of an American rapper, which is not terribly useful. The mm-hmm. film Foxy Brown, 1974, yeah, Pam Grier. So that's probably where the name came from, because the book is not called Foxy Brown. It is called something else. Anyway, Out of Sight, one of my all-time favorite movies by Steven Soderbergh, written by Elmer Leonard.
Okay. Well, I can understand the appeal of the tone of his writing. I don't necessarily agree with all of the words he uses, but yes. And I have to say that the use of language was probably the most jarring thing for me. Not the profanity. Profanity was fine. It was just every now and then you have somebody throwing around a word that's like, well, I don't know. You probably wouldn't want to use that term for a moneylender. It's not a good term for a moneylender.
I sense you're not referring to loan shark.
No, not loan shark. I think that one's fine. I think we've decided as a society that we will go ahead and make all sharks villainous by using the term loan shark. That's fine. But there are some other terms.
You know which sharks are not villainous?
Nurse sharks?
Baby sharks. Do-do-do-do-do. And for that, Grandma and Grandpa Sharks too.
You should do a reboot of this where there's a lone shark who anytime he goes around to do his stuff, everybody goes do.
It's Get Shorty reboot, but he comes to Hollywood to make children's television.
Oh yes, and that would make more sense because the short people would be the children and not Danny DeVito, so that would make sense.
It is kind of hilarious that Danny DeVito is the character in this movie that he is, because he's he's like the Tom Cruise of this universe or something. By the way, the other thing about Elmer Leonard movies is that they all exist in the same universe, which is a very weird thing, because you would think that they wouldn't necessarily do that because they're adapted books into movies, but like Dennis Farina is in a couple of them. He doesn't play the same character, but Michael Keaton's in two of them and he plays literally the same character. It's very strange.
That's weird.
Not the same director. I don't know that he has that much of a hand in the writing of it, but Elmer Leonard has like a cinematic universe around his stuff too, which is very strange.
Elmer Leonard cinematic universe.
Yes.
And this movie, of course, starts with Dennis Farina taking John Travolta's coat from the coat check in Miami. Again, a coat check in Miami.
It's a very, you know, mobster-esque kind of restaurant / diner. It's not really a diner.
It's an Italian restaurant.
Yeah, run Italian by, restaurant where they're having breakfast in the day.
Yeah, run by a guy who speaks Italian with a wait staff that speaks Italian.
Yeah, yeah. They're open in the daytime for the mob guys. It's a movie about the mob in the 90s, and how I appreciate how it's got a little bit of a sense of humor, and particularly the fact that John Travolta is basically just bored with the whole thing, and he's kind of like a movie nut, and he's like fantasizing and daydreaming about like a movie theater that's getting shut down because of the, you know, the protection money they can't pay, so they're gonna take it over and like turn it into something else or burn it down or whatever, and he's like, maybe he should buy it and let me run it as a movie theater, that'd be great. And the other guy's like, why would the mob guys want to buy a movie theater?
Yeah. Although going back to the lucrative business of mobsters and restaurants in Tampa, Florida, there was a restaurant called Malios for many years, Malios, which I think it was apostrophe S because it was possessive.
Malios Prime Steakhouse.
Could be, yeah. And it was basically either owned by the mob or just frequented by the mob, and that was widely known. So that was an interesting little piece of Tampa trivia, because the mob from up north loves Florida for reasons.
It's opened in 1969 by Malia Ivarone.
Sure,
how you pronounce that? Ivarone, like Barbone, not Barbone.
But anyway, he goes to get his coat. He can't get his coat. They say that Ray Barbone took it, and so he resolves to go get it back. He drives over to the place. This is the scene I was referring to, where they're obviously not in Miami driving. And then they get a tracking shot of him going through the place to the door and opening he knocks on the door, it opens, and Dennis Farina's on the other side. He punches Dennis Farina in the face and takes his coat and then leaves.
He's a pretty good mobster character. He's a no-nonsense, like, unintimidated by anybody character, which is, you know, what you want from your cool mobster characters. Dennis Farina plays the other great mobster character that you love, who's just incredibly loud and just like all ego, and he can back it up a little bit, but he's mostly just like a pain in everyone's ass.
Yeah, and but at the same time, neither one of them are the Hollywood archetypes that we know of necessarily or could predict, because that works against someone's someone's confidence later in the film. But before we get to
they're also not mob bosses, which is worth mentioning, because Dennis Farina is really mad that he got his nose broken. Oh, and then shortly hereafter, he goes to exact his own personal revenge, and Chili Palmer is apparently psychic or something, and pulls out his gun before Barbone kicks the door in and fires around. As soon as the door comes flying open, it just like skins a lion right over the top of Dennis Farina's head. And then he just shouts and runs away bleeding, which is kind of hilarious because it's Dennis Farina doing it. And he, you know, he goes to his boss and says, I want to kill him. He's like, you can't kill him. He works for a different mob family guy and we don't have beef with them because like you stole a jacket and he's mad. So get over it.
Yeah. And this is funny because I'm watching it and I'm like, this guy getting a back massage seems so familiar.
Getting a massage on a boat too. So it kind of sticks out too. You're like, why is he like on the deck of a little yacht getting a massage in a towel with his glasses over there?
I guess he learned his lesson about getting a massage in a hotel room. But
well, I think the lesson is you're never safe anywhere. But yeah, it turns out that gentleman is Mo Green from The Godfather.
Yeah, which is hilarious. I did not Google it at the time, but when you confirmed it later, I was like, I knew it because it was such course, a.
If you're gonna have a cameo of Mo Green, he's got to be getting a massage, just not shot in the eyeball.
Oh no, of course not. I'm sure the scene originally, as written, was like he's just on a boat, and then they're like, no, we cast Mo Green.
We got Mo Green here. He's gonna be getting a massage. It's gonna be great. He's gonna be all hairy and just look older. It's gonna be great.
Yeah.
What if this is in the same universe as The Godfather, and he faked his death?
Well, that would be convenient, and also have required confidence in his ability to rig some glasses, and then go underground and move to Miami.
Maybe it like slowed the bullet, so he lost an eye. He's got a glass eye now, but now he's just like undercover in Miami, hiding out.
Sure. It's better than a bullet that's slowly going towards his medulla oblongata.
Well, we didn't explore whether or not he could feel pain in this movie.
He's stronger every day until the day he dies. But so anyway, Mo Green is on a boat getting a massage.
Stronger every day, which is not the same as smarter every day, right? That's that YouTube thing.
No. Yeah, stronger than yesterday. Stronger. Anyway, so
I'm trying to remember his character name. It was very weird.
I don't remember. All the character names are very odd for the mob bosses.
Yeah, the mob bosses are all terrible. Was it Momo?
Momo is the one that John Travolta works for.
Right. And he's the one who has a heart attack.
Yes. But we haven't got to that yet. And I don't remember the name of this one, the Mo Green one. But it doesn't matter because we don't see him again ever. I'm sure this was a lovely day's worth of work for him.
Jimmy Cap. Played by Alex Rocco.
He did a good job just being there and reminding us of The Godfather. Now I would ordinarily lambast someone for that, but this movie has a very comedic tone to it, and I feel like that is worth doing if you're gonna do it, if you're gonna have Mo Green in there.
As you pointed out, this manages to have a comedic element without being a Zucker Brother movie.
I believe when we were slacking earlier, we were talking about how they managed to walk the fine line of homage to something like The Godfather and Goodfellas without falling victim to some of the mistakes that you might find in Mafia! Starring Jay Moore, which was also a 90s vehicle for mobster comedy. But
Christine Applegate.
Oh man.
You get what's his name there? Lloyd Bridges. I know I've seen this movie, I don't remember it at all.
All I remember is the mother in old lady makeup bites into a head of broccoli, and then that causes enough fiber to cause an explosion or something.
Oh, this is one of my this movie has one of my favorite quotes of all time. I just remembered.
I find that hard to believe. No, but I want to know what it is.
Is there not a scene where this little kid, when they're doing like the throwback to like how he got to America, doesn't he like get off a boat and he's like befriending like a young girl or something? And they're just like sitting around Ellis Island talking. Is that this movie?
I believe it is, but I don't remember anything about the scene.
I believe it's this movie. There's a line where he's like being separated from his family or whatever. Like they put him on the boat and they're like staying back in wherever, Italy. And like the grandma or the mother yells like, don't forget what I told you or whatever. And he goes like, soup is good as a good meal or something. Like he says, soup is good food or something. I can't remember the exact quote now.
Favorite line, huh?
Yeah, it makes me laugh because, you know, soup is a good meal. It's not just, you know, a course or an appetizer. I don't know why, of all the things from that movie, there's a line about soup that sticks with me.
The other week we were talking about how you're an old man now.
I like soup. Oh, God, I have to find this. It's not in the quotes on IMDb.
Oh, I wonder why. But I was sitting at lunch today at a...
Soup is good food. That's the name of it. And remember, Vincenzo, soup is good food. Mafia 1998. Oh, God. This...
So I was sitting having lunch, and I've got my kebab comes out to me, and I'm eating it. And then the guy next to me, a middle-aged gentleman, his bowl of soup comes, and then he starts eating it. And he's not sitting with anyone else. There's no one at his table. And he goes, mmm, really loudly. Like, I could hear the mmm. And I'm like, oh, my God, it is soup at Luna Grill. Like, it's just a Mediterranean fast food restaurant.
Was he really enjoying the soup, or was he trying to have a conversation with you about his soup?
He wasn't looking anywhere except at the soup. When he did it, I just was so startled by it. It was just like, you can't throw in an aggressive mmm like that, like just in general.
I feel like at some point that does happen unconsciously because it starts with sports. You know, I've reached the age where I will watch a sport event on the television I will start yelling and cheering when people do things. I don't know why. There's nobody in the house to hear me. I'm not trying to make a point to anyone, but I will make exclamatory remarks. And if the soup was good enough, maybe he was just, you know, reacting from his soul and professing his love.
If it was good. I mean, today you were messaging myself and several others the scores and stats of players for a game of lacrosse that was being played on ESPNU, a channel I did not know existed.
It's only existed for like 20 years. It's fine.
Okay. Well, I'm so sorry. You showed me.
Yeah, it is primary egg channel on my face. For collegiate lacrosse. If you're looking for most of it, it's usually on ESPNU.
I'm always looking for collegiate lacrosse. I've been doing it wrong all these years, but
you're really missing out because it's good. It's not like I find college basketball kind of interminable because it's a shorter game. It's a slower pace. Just watch NBA basketball. Like March Madness is like nonsense to me. I'm not really into it, but collegiate lacrosse is actually incredibly interesting to watch. And they just implemented, they brought down from Major League Lacrosse the 80-second shot clock. So it's even more fast paced now. It's great. It was a very good game between Princeton and Denver.
Okay. Great.
I have a lot of things to say about lacrosse.
Let me tell
you a story, young man, about back in my day.
just see you pull up to the Cocos or Caros or whatever in your red Miata, park your car, you walk in for the early bird special, you sit down.
I don't think we have Cocos or Caros around here, but sure, go ahead.
Yeah, whatever you got. And then you get your order of the tortilla soup, and you sit there, and you're eating it, and you're
tortilla.
Going...
It's French onion. It's always going to be French onion.
All right, fine. So you get your French onion from Mimi's Cafe, and...
Or like a cream of broccoli. I like those.
Okay, fine. Whatever. The soup isn't the important part of the story. You get your soup.
Soup is good food.
You get your soup, and then you go,
cheddar
mm.
potato. I'm like a cheddar potato. Mmm, good soup.
And then
Let
you
me
say
tell
that...
you, young whippersnapper, about back when I was playing lacrosse, I was real good for a little while.
And then you realize that you're the only person in the restaurant.
Oh. Let me regale you, young man.
All right. So anyway, moving on from that sad story to a different one. We get the opening titles, which look bomb. I love the choice of typography and the color palette used, because it is, of course, turquoise and magenta, which is delightful.
It manages to be Miami and 90s without being terrible.
Right, exactly. And, we get, the whole thing with, John Travolta talking to What's-His-Face in the barbershop where they seem to have their office, and, the what's his face is talking about how he's not gonna, you know, die in his sleep, so he's not gonna sleep in his bed, so he's just gonna sleep standing up sitting up in a diner down the street or whatever.
Yeah. So somebody had watched an episode of Seinfeld and decided to get some dialogue from there. But the point of the scene is that Momo has died of a heart attack from his surprise birthday party because he's very old and in very poor health and walked up a bunch of stairs and then was surprised, which you feel like maybe his closest friends and family would have known that like that would have been a bad idea, but it's fine, whatever. But basically, Mo Green now owns that territory. Ipso facto, Dennis Farina is kind of in charge of John Travolta because John Travolta is just, he's a collector. And he comes in, he's bossing John Travolta around. He's like, hey, this guy owes us 15 grand. Why didn't you go collect it? And he's like, he's dead. He's like, well, are you sure he's dead? It's like, yeah, he was on an airplane that blew up. We all saw it on TV. Like, we're pretty sure he's dead. He's like, he's being a hard ass. He's like, well, why don't you go find out if he had any life insurance or anything? Get our money. And he's like, all right, fine, whatever.
Mm. Oh, we should say at this point for our audience, there is no way I'm going to bleep everything that we're going to say in this conversation because this movie is very colorful.
Yeah, it's also rated R, so it's fine. Yes. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. I just want to save myself some editing.
Yeah, we'll cut this part out. We'll put it at the beginning of the episode, and we'll say
it's fine here. No, we didn't do anything. We didn't do anything until you said ass. And then from ass, it's go. So
you don't have
go.
To blur. You don't have to blur. Bleep ass. They say that on cable.
Okay. Well, I mean, anyway. there's worse words that they use in this.
We're not going to say all of them.
No, maybe we're not going to say all of them. But I just wanted to give you some buffer in case anything happens.
By the way, the next scene here where he goes and he has some sweet tea on a park bench with Leo's wife. Leo's the dead guy who blew up in the airplane who owed the money. You know who his wife is? What other movie she was in?
No.
She played Kevin Costner's ex-wife in Tin Cup.
Your favorite movie that I haven't watched.
My favorite. I would not classify. Well, but that also stars Rene Russo.
It's just that you've talked
cinematic
about...
Cinematic Universe. The Rene Russo Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, that'd be weird. You've talked about Tin Cup a lot. I feel like you've talked about Tin Cup more than anyone else ever.
No, that's not true. I feel like this characterization is going to make people think I'm a weirdo.
What about it would make people think you're a weirdo?
People who lack the familiarity with the movie are not going to understand what there is and isn't to like about that movie.
Oh, of course. So maybe someday we'll do Tin Cup for this podcast when it is available for convenient streaming.
Oh, I'm sure it's everywhere right now. It's always on TV, but I we're not going to do that because you don't care about golf.
Mm-mm.
Or like relationships.
No. Dennis Farina issues this mandate. He talks to the widow. The widow kind of feels him up and then says that she likes him, so she's going to tell him that the husband's a jerk and she wishes he was actually dead, but he went to Vegas. And then cut to John Travolta going to Vegas, and he goes to a set where out the window of the set you see part of a fake sign.
Yeah.
For a Las Vegas casino,
it's like they were really like all of the movies in the 90s were really getting some use out of the old Batman sets.
It is not a good set. Like there's nothing about the set that leads you to believe that this is an impressive Las Vegas casino. This is just like, here's a room and there's a window, and then out the window are some lights that let you know this is Vegas. This could be anywhere else on the planet.
It's fine. It's one scene full of exposition about what happened to the guy, where he is. He's definitely still alive. He's a jerk. He was, smacking waitresses on the butt, so they kicked him out and put him on a plane to Los Angeles and said, get out of here. That's where he is now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I guess the important part is, since Chili Palmer is pals with the Las Vegas casino guy, because, you know, the mob and stuff, he's like, if you're really going to Los Angeles, maybe you could take care of something else for us while you're there. There's this other guy who owes us $150,000. He's 60 days late. Maybe go, like, you know, sweat him or something and see if you can get our cash back. And he's like, yeah, sure, whatever. We're buddies. We see each other at the mobster holiday party, so...
Cut to LAX, and this is the kind of LAX scene, as well as many other LAX scenes in this movie, that you can only do in the 90s, I guess, because you can't do this now.
The bit with the lockers?
Yeah, the bit with the lockers, where...
Delroy Lindo. Oh, he's from England.
So anyway, there's...
You know him from things.
Sure. So Delray Lindo has the stuff where they're trying to get the thing from the locker, and they reveal that there's the Colombian guy who was supposed to go get it, but he doesn't want to do it because he doesn't want to get pinched by the guys who are watching this locker.
He doesn't want to get pinched. Yeah, they're doing an exchange, drugs for money, and he hands over the drugs, and he's like, yeah, your money's in a locker over there. But be careful about when you go get it, because the DEA is hanging out here. And he's like, well, what the hell? You're supposed to give me the money by hand. This is not very helpful. And then, you know, eventually he kind of like panics and freaks out and thinks that everyone in the airport is going to arrest him, like old ladies, small children, everything. So he just kind of like runs away.
Yeah. And that'll come back later. But the important thing is that Travolta breaks into a house in the middle of the night, and it's Gene Hackman in bed with Rene Russo. An implausible scenario, if you ask me. Rene Russo is waking him up to go downstairs because she hears something from downstairs. And
which
he says,
part
oh, it's
is
just
most
the TV.
Implausible? Is it just the relationship in general, or is it the fact that Rene Russo is like a like D horror movie star, or that Gene Hackman is directing those movies?
I think all of the above.
Hmm.
Most of the stuff around her character is not well written. Compared to, I feel like they spent more time, the writer of the original piece, I guess, could be faulted for this, or the screenwriter. The screenwriter certainly had the opportunity to step in and make her character less of somebody who just has sex with everybody in the movie. That's not the case. she's having sex with, or post-sex with Gene Hackman, and wants him to go downstairs. He's an unsuccessful producer, and she's an unsuccessful actress, but she has this house, and the dialogue lets you know that this is not his house, and they are not together, that he is just over. He's reluctant to go downstairs, and he says, oh, it's probably the dog that pushed the remote, and then she says she doesn't have a dog, and he's just like, oh, what happened to Muffy? I like Muffy.
Who names a dog Muffy?
I don't know. It's not a good dog name. But he gets up and he looks at the pool and he says, you should really have somebody skim that.
that's a part that's in this movie two times, three times. And it's just like, it's there for no reason. And it's stupid, but it makes me laugh.
Yeah, well, it's twice. John Travolta says it later. But it's just funny. It lets you have a little touch of something in here that it's not as pristine and, you know, like flawlessly Hollywood, I guess. So anyway, he goes downstairs. It's Letterman on the big CRT TV. He goes up to turn it off because that's the only way you can walk into a room at night, I guess.
And at this point, being so far removed from Letterman being on the air, I was a little sad. I'm like, no, don't turn that off. I'm watching that. That sounded like a funny joke he was telling.
Yeah, well, it goes off. And then the light goes on and reveals that John Travolta is there. And there's a whole exchange about breaking in and stuff. But then John Travolta is like, let me tell you about my movie idea. And then cut to Rene Russo in bed going, why am I still hearing people talking and crap?
And so laughing.
She goes downstairs.
Yeah, downstairs.
Yeah, she goes downstairs. She finds them at her kitchen table laughing it up, yucking it up, talking about the movie idea that he has. He explains through flashback the whole thing with the dry cleaner and the dry cleaner's wife, and he got a nervous feeling, so he got off the plane. Then the plane crashed, and we see like a really bad plane crash.
It was fine for the time.
Yeah, and then it's funny more than anything, but yeah. It's supposed to be.
The plane crashed, but they were delayed for mechanical reasons, so he got off and got drunk and blacked out at the bar. And then when the plane exploded, he used it as his excuse to disappear and then also con the airline out of insurance money. And then that's what he took to Vegas. So now he's got, not only does he have the 15 grand that he owes the mobsters, he has $300,000, which apparently he just keeps, you know, like hidden under some robes in his hotel closet because he's stupid.
Yeah, well, apparently when he was in Vegas, he turned his $300,000 into like a million or something, I think he says. I can't remember through gambling, just successful gambling. And he doesn't have his wife come out to join him, so the wife is upset. And so he's recounting this real story to Gene Hackman, and Gene Hackman's like, oh, this is amazing, and he's explaining it to Renee Russo, because she just walked in. And Renee Russo's like, well, that was the plane crash that was on TV for weeks, so that's a real story. Like, that's not...
Yeah, because when he's pitching the story to them all, he's like, that's all I got. He's like, what do you mean? That's like half a movie. He's like, how's it end? He's like, well, you know, get in a couple of different ways. And it's like, oh, this is true. And then... He's in the mob.
It's very meta.
Yeah. It's good, though. It gets even more meta by the end of the movie, which I really actually kind of like.
Mm-hmm. And so we have them agree that they're going to do something.
It's worth probably at this point pointing out that, like, the story is very convoluted, the way they get from place to place to place. But it does make sense, and it probably makes more sense in a novel. But, like... It's overly complicated for a movie plot at points, which is kind of a hallmark of Elmore Leonard adaptation movies, but I don't know. It still works, right? Like, did you feel like it? I mean, for me, it feels overly complicated, but I feel like it still works. But what do you think?
I agree. It's overly complicated, but I didn't get lost in the mechanics of it. So that's all fine. Like, nothing happened where I was like, but why? Like,
right, it's definitely the kind of movie that you have to sit down and pitch over a table in the middle of the night with somebody else while you're having a drink. It's not the kind where you can... there's no elevator pitch for this movie, really. Like, you could say just, like, Loan Shark moves to L.A. to get into the movie business or something, but that doesn't really cover the story.
No, I mean, a Loan Shark moves to L.A. to get into this business, but he still has an active Loan Shark collection that is going on and sort of a boss that is involved in that. As well as other Hollywood forces that he comes to deal with. So there are several points of intersection with many other stories, but they decide to go to Gene Hackman's office to look at this thing, and when they get there, they meet what's-his-face and the other guy. And they come in.
he wants to work with Gene Hackman on a movie. Gene Hackman's got another thing he's got going on right now, but he sort of tells, you know, mob fixer guy, like, I'm kind of in trouble. Like, these other bad guys loaned me $200,000 to, like, have a part in a movie because they wanted money and investing and stuff. But I needed $500,000 to buy a script. So I, like, bet it in Vegas and lost it all, which is a very bad move. And now the bad limo guys want their money, or they want their movie. And, they, you know, Chili attempts to negotiate his way out of that for him. But, Mr. Zim, being kind of an idiot, like, puts his foot in his mouth and basically says, there's this other really great movie we have to do first, so don't worry about it. And they're basically like, oh, well, like, let us be part of that movie instead of the other one.
John Travolta tells him very specifically, don't do any talking. And the second the door opens, Gene Hackman does all of the talking and does not shut up. And then afterwards, he's like, oh, I couldn't just, like, sit there and not say anything.
I kind of love Gene Hackman's character in this movie, though. He's just like... He's schmoozy in that Hollywood way that is very, like, realistic, but also, like, dorky. But he's a director too.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a hack. So suitable.
He makes B movies. But this big one, the Mr. Lovejoy one that he wasn't supposed to mention, is the one that's going to, like, get him out of making, you know, the Swamp Thing movies or something. And he refers to it as his driving Miss Daisy, which is an interesting way to phrase it.
Very. And then we have, what was it? John Travolta, like, wants to get in on this producing business, but he knows he has to follow up on this other thing. So he goes to what's-his-face's place, and he gets all the money out of there. And he's just taking what was owed. He's not pursuing the rest of it, but he's like, you're an idiot. Like, you just put it in a bank. And he explains, like, you just use a safety deposit box. And then he's like, oh, okay. She's like, what a fool. Because, like many of the characters in this movie, nobody really knows how, like, illegal things work. They all just kind of know what Hollywood represents illegal things to be. Their fears are also kind of based on that.
The guys in LA that are good at it, like, the limo driver guys that are like still kind of good at intimidating and like selling drugs and money laundering, they don't have like the experience of like the East Coast mob guys that Chili is familiar with. So he's just like, I know how to deal with all of you idiots. You're trying to intimidate me, but I'm just not feeling it.
Yeah. And the same goes for Dennis Farina when he shows up later. But this exchange where he gets the stuff and then leaves, and the guy's like, oh, you can't just take whatever from me in this loan, and I know the rates. And he's like, so? Like, what are you going to do about it? He leaves to go pursue this, and he talks to Karen, Rene Russo, and they're going to go talk to Marty, who's, it turns out, is her ex. And then it turns out that John Travolta knew in a past profession the current wife, Nikki, who has an interesting affectation of not shaving certain places for specifically Danny DeVito's character's request, which is curious, but it's in the movie, so it's there.
It's in the movie.
Yeah, and they arrive in the Cadillac of minivans, the Pontiac Silhouette.
Is that what it was, the Pontiac Silhouette?
I believe that is what they said. And
it looks like a dustbuster. It's very pointy on one end and not at all pointy anywhere else.
I used to see a lot of these vans, and I see none of them. So I have to assume that they are impossible to maintain. But yeah, it is unfortunate looking. There was also a Toyota Previa, which had a similar sort of blunted, weird look.
Those were a little bit more rounded on the back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was the Oldsmobile Silhouette before.
Oh right. You're right. It was the Oldsmobile Silhouette. I made a mistake. It wasn't the Pontiac.
This thing 100% looks like a dustbuster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so pointy and wedge-like in the front. I assume the wedge helps with aerodynamics. The aerodynamics of minivans. I was surprised that there's not like a car chase or anything, or the car doesn't really like play into any aspect of this. There's nothing about the car.
The fakeness of Danny DeVito's character when he's just like, when Chili is like saying, yeah, you know, I rental car, I got used to his Cadillac of minivans or whatever, and he takes it for a test drive and then later shows up in his own because he wants to be cool by also driving an Oldsmobile Silhouette minivan, apparently.
Yeah. Well, what I thought was funny about that was when he shows up in that, I fully expected that to turn into a plot point of somebody getting confused for somebody else because they're driving the same car, like somebody's going to tail them, and then that doesn't happen. And so it's just like, oh, I guess it was just the simple joke of it being the same car for vanity, weird ego reasons, and not for just, you know, the added narrative elements of it. But
you put a subconscious hat on your hat.
Yeah, I overthought that. Trends
arise and fall very quickly in Los Angeles because it's a very fast town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if I describe it as fast as much as trendy. The mansion that Danny DeVito lives in with Nikki is, I think, identical to the mansion that Fester and Debbie have in Adam's Family Values.
Is that right?
It has the same staircase and entrance way and everything. It looks exactly the same. I would have to actually look it up, but I'll place a bet of exactly $20, 20 human earth dollars that it is that. Except I'm not placing that bet with anyone because that would be ridiculous. I'm just going to say that like as a turn of phrase.
Wait, who's Bo Catlett? Is that one of the characters in here? Oh, Bo Catlett is the one up on the mountain.
Yeah. So the Bo Catlett is the guy who has the fixation with knocking people over of things.
Here's Martin Weir's house. It is Crescent Drive, Beverly Hills, California. Well, this is probably just the outside of it.
Right. Well, I would assume it was the inside too. I don't think they built a set for that, but it looks like the same location that was used for Adam's Family Values. So if you look up, do you cross collate the Adam's Family Values locations for Debbie and Fester's mansion, I believe you'll find a similar location. If not for the exterior, but at least the interior.
I'm working on it. I'm collating. I'm comparing. Processing. I'm filming locationsing. Let's see. Debbie's childhood home. Adam's family mansion. It is not listed on IMDb.
Well, that's a crime.
So, Adam's family values locations. Debbie Mansion. Filming locations. This is, let's see. Also Barry Sonnenfeld.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying that.
This is just about the lake and stuff. I want the house. Tell me about the house. It's not helpful. This is not good radio.
No, I put an edit point here. But since we can't find this house,
we're not going to edit this.
Okay. So since we can't find this house, I'm just going to have to just believe in myself and that this double stairwell entryway, everything is the same place. But John Travolta and Rene Russo talk to Danny DeVito about this script, get him interested in it, except Danny DeVito is more interested in John Travolta, who is an actual mob guy. John Travolta is very interested in Danny DeVito's character because he compliments him on his performance as a fink in a certain role. And they go back and forth about like how to make things believable. John Travolta, you know, says like, you got to look at somebody and you know, that's the way you look at them. That's how, whatever it happens. And, Danny DeVito tries it and he's like, no, you can't look at that. Like, are you sleepy? Like, what are you doing? He's like, you can't, have any emotion when you're doing it. Like, it's just, you're, you know, owning whatever it is. So that's an interesting thing. That's primarily why Danny DeVito seems interested in this relationship, this business relationship, is because of John Travolta's involvement, because he has something that's entertaining him, basically. As a Hollywood star, he has something to use and to see and to enjoy. He's not surrounded. It's not the usual person trying to get him to do something. So that sort of explains Martin's involvement in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's very bad.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Beaucollet kills the guy who tried to get the stuff out of the locker and refused at his home, and the guy falls over and dies, and we're like, oh, that was not great, but turns out it was worse than not great much later in the film,
because he turns out to be is it literally Pablo Escobar, Mr. Escobar's
well he just says Mr. Escobar, but I don't know if he's referred to as Pablo Escobar, but it's played by veteran character actor Miguel Sandoval, who you've seen in literally everything.
The cast in this movie is actually quite good, I find.
Yes, yes. It's a veritable who's who of where have I seen that. So it's good that they're all here.
Right down to the cameos of like Penny Marshall and Harvey Keitel.
Oh, man. Penny Marshall. That was so funny. But yeah, so they have the exchange over doing this and the agreement, and Danny DeVito does his test drive, and Bo knocks the guy over and tells Bear, who's played by Gandolfini, who will go on to do a very major turn as a mob boss himself in a certain HBO series.
Without a ponytail.
Without a ponytail. And without a certain weird accent that he's pulling off here. What's funny is everybody's putting on a tough New York accent for this, except him. He's doing the opposite of that. I don't know. He's supposed to be some sort of country bumpkin or something. I have no idea what's going on with his accent. It's weird.
He's country Appalachian something. He's got his shirts with the trees and the birds on him.
Mm. Well, except that his speech pattern is not that of somebody who lives in Costa Mesa as much as somebody who may have had relatives that moved to Costa Mesa. So I don't think that that all vibes together, but yeah, he is a peculiar way of speaking. Does he have something going on with his teeth, or is that just me? Just me.
Like what?
I don't know. There was something like almost beaverish about what he was doing with his teeth. I don't know how to explain it. It was peculiar.
But I don't know. Does he have weird teeth in general?
No. It could have just been how he was trying to carry himself for this. But yeah, he plays a stunt guy who's a tough guy for Bo. That'll come into play later. But Gene Hackman takes it upon himself to, you know, try to get a better deal by going around everybody and going to... I'm skipping a lot of...
Yeah, Chili's strong-arming him, saying, I'm not going to give you the $300,000 that I stole from Leo, because if I gave you that money, you would just blow it and you're not in charge. I'm the producer now, whatever, you listen to me. And but by virtue of the fact that he's had conversations with Chili, he's heard of Ray Barbone back in Miami, because he kind of, you know, he works for him and he's a bad guy. And he doesn't quite understand the casual manner in which Chili says, you don't want to get him involved in this because he's not a movie fan. And he doesn't quite understand the severity of that. So he calls Ray Barbone to try and say, like, hey, Chili Palmer's out here and he's got your money. And you should come out here and take a meeting with a very powerful Mr. Zim. And he'll tell you where your money is. And then you can invest in a movie property. I think one of Dennis Farina's greatest skills was being Dennis Farina in a city that he doesn't live in, like when he's in
like in Snatch.
Yeah, exactly, when he goes to London. Same sort of thing there. He's just like, he's not fish out of water, he's like fish burning down an entire town because he hates everyone and everything all the time. But he hates Los Angeles, like, yeah. I love that they're stuck in freeway traffic and the guy's like, this is how we would go to the beach. He's like, I'm from Miami Beach and you want to show me the ocean? How dare you.
And the guy's like, well, they say the smog is why we have such beautiful sunsets. And then later on, when Dennis Farina is talking to Gene Hackman, he has a profanity-laced version of that he shares with Gene Hackman, which I found quite entertaining.
He's great when he has absolutely no patience for anyone's nonsense. Like, he shows up in Snatch, he wants his diamond, whatever. Here, he wants his money, he wants to kill Chili Palmer, he wants to go back to Miami, and he's got to go run errands, and he's not a fan of that.
Yeah, and obviously, I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I think Guy Ritchie saw this movie.
It's very possible.
I'm just going to guess. Dennis Farina is very good at being incredulous and angry, and it all comes through here. And what's funny is Gene Hackman is doing this performance where he thinks he's being tough. He thinks he's doing the things that tough guys would do when he's issuing his ultimatum over the phone to Dennis Farina that he needs to come out there.
Yeah, he watched 5 seconds of Chili Palmer, and he did what people in Hollywood do. They're like, I can do that, and I'll just do the same thing.
Yeah, and the guy's like, or what? Like, what are you going to do? And he's like, just use your imagination. Hangs up the phone. And Dennis Farina is just like, what? Like, the expression on his face is just like a total, like, he's perplexed that he's dealing with somebody like this. Like, this can't be like a real thing. So of course he goes out there and he busts down the door, and there's Gene Hackman asleep on his desk waiting for Dennis Farina to show up. And Dennis Farina is not the mob boss that Gene Hackman thought he would get, where it would be like, oh, I'm very intimidated, you know, and I'll go along with what you say because you're talking so tough. No, not Dennis Farina. He
he beats the crap out of him. He flips his desk over and threatens to kill him, and he's like standing on his head. And then luckily for Gene Hackman, one of the stupid limo guys shows up. Uncle Rico, John, what's his name? John Grease? Grise? Mm-hmm. I forget how you pronounce it.
I've seen him in so many things, but I don't know his name.
Yeah. He shows up and, you know, he tries to do his threatening guy thing, which doesn't go over super well for him, because Dennis Farina, you know, he's trying to do is like, look, I got a bigger gun than you. Like, what are you going to do about it? Guy in a shiny suit. And he's like, my little gun works just fine. It shoots him 5 times in the chest. He's like, look at that. And then he gives the gun to Gene Hackman. He's like, you know, when the police show up, they're going to want to, you know, test you for gunshot residue. So I need you to put one bullet in the dead body there. And he hands it to Gene Hackman while he's still standing on his face. And Gene Hackman, like, points the gun upward at Dennis Farina's crotch. And He's unconcerned. He's just like, you're not going to shoot me. Stop fooling around. Just point the gun over there and shoot the dead body.
Mm-hmm. And he like manipulates him into doing it. And when they later talk about all the places where the guy was shot, and it's like, oh, and the foot too.
Five times in the chest and once in the foot. Yeah. And
it's like, you could tell which one was the Gene Hackman shot.
Yes. And it's so great that around town at the Ivy, Harry Zim has become like a local hero because he killed some like bad guy who was pressuring him or something. And everyone knows about it, even though he got his jaw broken, presumably from a phone hitting him in the face. And he's got broken hands and his neck is in a brace. But everyone's applauding him. And they're like, wow, look at you. You're famous. You should have shot somebody years ago.
Yeah. And I should mention that Bette Midler is in this movie and just materializes out of nowhere. And I'm just like, why are you here?
She owns the Mr. Lovejoy script since her husband mm-hmm. died. And she also happens to be sort of dating Gene Hackman, kind of.
What's weird is Gene Hackman is very... he doesn't want it. He doesn't want this relationship
he wants
necessarily. Yeah. But so he kind of goes along with it. It's very strange. It's a very strange relationship. And then later, though, she's the one who calls them to the hospital, which is why I brought her up. And so Chili Palmer and Karen arrive and see Gene Hackman unable to talk. He's loaded up with Demerol and he can't speak and he's going to have his jaw wired shut and they're going to basically have some interns do it, I guess, from the dialogue. And Karen tells Gene Hackman's foot that they're doing this thing at the Ivy, but, you know, he's going to be incapacitated. So she thinks it's going to be in everyone's best interest if she just goes with Chili and stuff. And so they're surprised when they see Gene Hackman show up. And he's like unable to really move in any meaningful way. And he's got a horrible sport coat draped over him. And he, he takes a seat and everyone's, you know, applauding him, as you said, and talking about like how amazing it was that he did the thing he did. And Chili is there and Karen is there. And then Danny DeVito shows up in his Oldsmobile silhouette. He hops out of it, hands the keys to the valet, goes up and says he doesn't have much time, so you know, he wants to make sure they've already ordered, and they haven't, so he calls over somebody at the table, and in an earlier scene, Karen said they always, you know, stars always order off of menu, and he does that, and he orders an omelet, an egg white omelet, with lightly browned shallots in a little bit of olive oil, strawberry frappes with the strawberries in them and two straws for Gene Hackman. And then before the food comes out, he gives them all a little like Hollywood, you know, everything's great, love you, see you, bye, and then leaves the table. And so then they're presented with a platter that has lettuce around the perimeter and slices of Roma tomatoes, and then two egg white omelets with shallots. And
it's so big too. It's like an omelet that could feed 15 people.
Yeah, well, he ordered an omelet for the table, so I'm sure that the waitress is like, one omelet would not feed all of these people.
First of all, how long would it take to separate that many egg whites?
I'm gonna let you in on a little secret, Dan. There is a product. There's a product that is available for purchase, which is egg whites in a container that you can just pour.
Gross.
Mm. It's very popular.
Yeah.
And convenient too. You ever had egg beaters, Dan?
I'm sure I have.
It's good for your cholesterol, according to my mother.
Is that right?
Yes. Which I'm sure is part of the, I guess, part of the reason Danny DeVito is like light olive oil for the egg white olive. I don't know. It's the 90s.
He wants it to be as dry and flavorless as possible.
It's very weird. Also, just shallots, lightly browned shallots. But
I like shallots too, but brown the damn shallots, for Christ's sake.
Well, I don't know how you lightly brown a shallot in the 30 seconds that they had their conversation.
Yeah.
Movie magic. They, I don't know if they ate it. It would have been funny if they were like burping later and were just like, oh man, I can't digest these shallots that were lightly brown. they have a...
Oh no, my shallots.
Hmm. So what was it? What, I mean, was there cheese in this omelet? There was no cheese ordered in part of the specification. So I have no idea.
It's like, a very healthy, very low carb, you know, breakfast meal for the table that everyone should get on board with.
If I ever order an omelet that doesn't have cheese in it, I want someone to like strangle me to death on the spot. Because
I think no matter what you're putting in or on your eggs, adding cheese is probably okay.
Well, adding cheese is always okay, but unless you have an issue with cheese, but adding cheese is always okay. But for an omelet, it's mandatory because otherwise you just have a folded piece of flat egg. There's no creaminess. You need the creaminess.
An egg white omelet with nothing in it, which is not technically an egg white or not technically an omelet. Jesus, can't even get the quote right. Gross point blank. Remember?
Oh, I forget.
Maybe Danny DeVito didn't want to get into an argument about it. He just wanted the protein.
Well, anyway, there was a lot of protein. But
I love the way it comes out on a silver platter, like it's a giant, like uncut trout or something.
It's very weird. Also, I wouldn't presume to know anything about the trout status, but there's a sunset shot here where it's day for sunset, where we're at Karen's place, looking out on the water, presumably somewhere in Malibu, I guess.
You are correct.
And the water that you're looking at, you can see the reflection of the sun on it, and it is way up in the sky. It is not near the water, but they put a big old orange brown filter over the whole thing to let you know that it was sunset, Top Gun style. And they had their little chit chat there, looking at the water. There's nothing dynamic about this scene. It's just orange. It's an orange scene.
Strawberry frappe and an orange scene.
Yeah. And they just chit-chat about all this stuff, and then they have relations of a manner, a sort thing. At this point, Escobar has arrived in town, and Bo is aware of it, and he's upset about the whole thing, and he needs to get out of town. Oh wait, that was way earlier, because that's the reason why. What's his face? Anyway, it doesn't matter. All these storylines are very confusing, so just forget it. That's why the guy got shot by Dennis Farina. But
Catlett needs money to pay back Escobar the $500,000 that he left in the locker at the airport, but he doesn't want to go get it because the DEA will arrest him. But he heard that Chili's got $300,000 from that other guy. So he decides to just go rob Chili. So he breaks into the house and does the same thing sort of that Chili did with the watching the TV. And she's like, he's doing the same thing. It's gotta be Zim. And he's like, no, I don't think that's Letterman. I think that's Rio Bravo. She's like, shut up, go downstairs and take care of this. But basically he's like, give me the money, or I'm going to shoot you. And then like he shoots in the lamp or something, and there's a, you know, struggle, and he grabs, Rene Russo and kidnaps her. He's like, meet me at my house with the money. And then he shows up immediately after they get to the house, which I find hilarious. Cause he's like, what are you guys doing? Like, why couldn't we drive together? We could have saved some gas or something. It's fine. Here's the money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what I think is weird, though, about this scene is I find it implausible that Chili would go downstairs and walk all the way up to the CRT to turn it off and then turn on a lamp, because he did this trick to Gene Hackman. So why would he not just turn on a light?
He's very interested in the movie, though. He likes John Wayne, apparently.
I guess it just doesn't make any sense that he would be so disarmed by this. But anyway, Bo gets Karen. They go to his place, and he gives him the directions to his place in Laurel Canyon, which is funny. But then Karen is upset that Bo has a pink toilet, and
Martin Weir's book next to it.
But she comes out and talks to John Travolta to show that she's alive, and then they turn around to leave, and then Bo says, oh, but you entered my property, and so now I've got you breaking in, and I've got a witness, and that is, of course, James Gandolfini. What he doesn't know is that James Gandolfini has been turned by the charming personality of John Travolta when they were in the airport parking lot.
Because everybody's got a dream, and, you know, Gandolfini doesn't like being a muscle dude. He wants to go back to, you know, working in movies, and he promises that he can help him out with that, because he's turning over leaf, new leaf, and becoming a producer, so he can bring him in on that whole thing. So James Gandolfini like beats him up a bunch in a very sort of calculated way that sort of like pushes him out to the deck, so he can kind of like back Catlett up against the railing. And just as he had suggested earlier, James Gandolfini had taken the bolts out of the railing, so he goes over and dies on the rocks below, but Chili Palmer is saved.
Yeah, and then James Gandolfini is like, I don't need this evidence, and then scatters it all over the ground.
I don't need this evidence with my fingerprints all over it.
I mean, mainly, having all those bolts there on the ground lets you know that somebody had purposefully removed them, that they didn't accidentally fall out.
I mean, for all the police now, he could have been like, you know, working on his railing late at night, like taking those down to put up some new like oak or something, and he just slept.
Right, because you know he started by shooting the railing with his gun, and then decided that he would just unscrew it. That's the plausible scenario to explain the crime scene. Because remember, Rene Russo does shoot and splinter one of the railing. There, but. But it's funny because John Travolta's like, what are you doing? Stop it. And they all get back up. Hilarious. And so they leave with the money. And Bo's dead. And they are going to finance this movie now. And but before they can do that, John Travolta needs to go back to his place, his hotel. And so they pull up somewhere on Sunset Boulevard, and they just leave his car there with Rene Russo in it while he goes upstairs. He opens the door, turns on the light, and Dennis Farina is revealed to be standing in the doorway of the bathroom. Dennis Farina confronts him about the money and all this crap he has had to go through and how he wants the money and stuff. And so then he finds John Travolta's... The storage locker key on him when he's searching his person.
Apparently, it's the Sunset Tower Hotel in West Hollywood. By the way,
I knew it was on Sunset.
Formerly the Argyle.
He's so happy that he's got this key now. He can go get all the money, and they're just gonna forget about this whole thing. You know, they're not gonna. You know, worry about it. Like, there's no reason why they should be enemies. Blah 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 blah.
Yeah,
You're so stupid.
We're not so different, you and I. You know, I don't have to kill you as long as you let me walk away with this $300,000. It's in this storage locker that I'm just completely assuming is accurate because I didn't let you say anything.
Yes. But we, as the audience, are enamored by this because we all know what's going to happen. And there's a little smirk on John Travolta's face because he's an actor who's letting us know that he knows what is going to happen.
this is a cool hotel, by the way.
I mean, the exterior, I don't know if I'd want to stay in that, but
some of the rooms are kind of nice.
But Dennis Farina takes the opportunity to call an idiot on his way out of the room. He goes down to a taxi cab and, you know, says to go to the airport. There's a weird thing where he's like standing at the curb and he points at the ground to make the cab
driver pull up. He walks out and he's like, his cab is waiting for him, but he refuses to walk 10 steps to the left. He just stands there and points and says, what's so hard about pulling up in front of me? You can see I'm over here. Like, come over here.
Yeah. And so they leave to go to the airport. He walks confidently up to the lockers with his key and opens it. All of the DA agents spring on him. And presumably he's captured, but we don't actually get that. What we get is that same pink blazer he's wearing. Cut to Harvey Keitel spinning around with that same pink blazer and bruised nose makeup. And he's confronted by...
Very brown and tan looking.
He's confronted by Danny DeVito, who has a fake gun that he doesn't know how to fire. And there's a screaming blonde girl next to him. And it's a very fake looking LAX set. Penny Marshall is there and she calls cut because he didn't push the buttons on it right.
He pushes the button, the magazine falls out of the bottom instead of it actually firing.
Yes, and so they gotta reset the whole thing, and this is when Gene Hackman says that they'll just, you know, call, wrap for the day and they'll pick it up tomorrow. And Bette Midler points out that they should have gone into overtime to finish the scene because they're already 2 weeks behind on their second day of shooting.
That's great.
Yeah. And Rene Russo and John Travolta are chit-chatting with somebody about something. And then they turn around and head on out of there to go eat at Morton's. And they leave in his van. Helicopter shot out of the Sony studio lot.
I had a very disappointing meal at Morton's recently.
Ah, oh, was this when you were in Anaheim?
Uh-huh. It was not great.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I didn't think it would be good. So this meets my expectations.
I don't think it reflects specifically on Morton's. I think this sort of like 80s 90s like overly expensive traveling salesman steakhouse kind of place is just hemorrhaging and dying because they can't keep the quality up or the atmosphere interesting. So it's just like it continues to decline and their prices are still incredibly high.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
It's very disappointing. I used to enjoy a Morton's or another steakhouse.
Yeah, I've only been to a Morton's once and I had a slider. Any mistake?
You had a slider?
Yeah, it was a happy hour special.
Okay.
It was an order of sliders. It was three sliders.
It's nice.
Mm-hmm. It was fine. I obviously did not feel the need to go back to Morton's. Actually, I have not.
There is a steakhouse in on the border of Tempe and Phoenix called the Stockyards that used to be an actual Stockyards that turned into a steakhouse like in the 50s or something. And they do a thing where they have like a really old school bar that's basically original, just like these wooden columns. And it's very like cowboy looking in there. But they have a happy hour. I don't know if it's every day of the week, but they have like free sliders from their like that they make out of their steaks and they're very good. And you can just have as many as you want for free while you drink in their cool looking bar.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds like a good deal.
Yeah. I ate like seven of them and had a bunch of drinks. And then we went and saw a baseball game.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Do you love your moderately priced foods and sports?
I like costly foods and sports.
Well, that was free. So I'm just averaging.
Oh, sure. You're averaging my expensive steak dinners with my free sliders.
Yeah.
That's how that works. That's how I can justify those things.
Yeah. I mean, that's how the restaurants justify those things because the sliders are just the trimmings.
It's true.
But delicious trimmings.
Delicious trimmings.
And that's, you know, this is how you use every part of the dry aged steak. Yeah, this was actually a fairly interesting movie. I have no desire to revisit this anytime soon.
What would you say if I told you there was a sequel made 10 years later?
I would be absolutely shocked. What are we talking about here? A sequel? Like a literal sequel?
A literal sequel starring John Travolta, Uma Thurman, Vince Vaughn, Cedric the Entertainer, Andre Benjamin, The Rock, Harvey Keitel, and Christina Milian.
I don't believe you.
Danny DeVito's in it as well. It's called Be Cool.
There's a
book sequel. And
I remember this because it came out when I was in college.
Yes, it did. It was very bad. If they were going to make this sequel, they should have made it a long time before 2005.
Wow. Ooh.
Anyway, you were going to say you had some thoughts wrapping up about the movie.
Oh, no, I enjoyed watching this. It doesn't age terribly well. It is very weird. If you were making this today, I'm not sure you could, just by virtue of some of the language used. But it's still interesting in terms of tone and character. For this stuff and the funny convoluted stuff that occurs to get people from point A to point B, and C and D and E, but there's a lot of just like kookiness to it, and I think you know, if you like Nice Guys and stuff like that, where there's like kind of a convoluted story about people doing something and then it winding up being this other thing by the end of it, then you know, that's a kind of the same thing, kind of your hard-boiled, in this case mob, in other cases detective kind of story, your noirish kind of vibe going. Mm-hmm. And you get it's a real opportunity for these actors to embody these characters, and they seem to be having a lot of fun, I would assume. Just based on their performances, they seem to be enjoying themselves. So it's nice. This is unremarkable in terms of cinematography or direction, but it's interesting that they could put this together without it turning into something that is sort of a parody, mockery kind of thing, like Mafia, exclamation mark, or other movies.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, I was going to suggest at the end of this, in a sort of masochistic way, that maybe we watch the sequel after this just to see how the two of them compare. But I would like to rescind that and say maybe we just do a couple more Elmore Leonard movies.
I thought you were going to say Mafia.
No, I don't want to watch Mafia. I want to watch the
better
stuff.
But it has your favorite line about soup.
Soup is good food. Yeah, no, I appreciate that line. Especially considering I remember, what year was Mafia made? I just looked this up.
Oh, I don't know.
So bad. So bad.
I say like 97, 98?
It's
maybe?
It's not even on the first page of Google when I Google Mafia! Exclamation point. 1998, you're correct. I think maybe we should watch Jackie Brown and Out of Sight, because I think both of those movies are better than this movie, and they're both similar in tone and plotting and in interesting ways with interesting characters. That sounded pained.
Okay.
I know that at least Out of Sight is streaming on Prime, because I just looked at it right now as an excuse.
We will investigate these opportunities that have been afforded to us.
I appreciate your Hollywood speak coming at me right there.
Yeah. As Gene Hackman points out, he didn't commit to anything.
What does that even mean in this town? Consider it.
It's funny because it's true. With that, I will consider ending this podcast.
Yeah, you know how you can tell this movie is not quite real is that nobody offered anyone a bottle of water.
Oh.
Although it was the 90s, maybe they didn't really have as much bottled water.
Well, they didn't seem to have a studio operation where they would have an assistant. Because an assistant would have intervened in some of these scenes.
Although, you know, when they get to the restaurant, I don't know how the first thing out of the waiter's mouth wasn't sparkling or still. Like, that's got to be just in there, period.
And remember the restaurant scene in L.A. Story? It's the very beginning of the movie.
Have I seen L.A. Story?
I don't know. Have you seen L.A. Story? The Steve Martin movie?
L.A. Story.
It's not a very good movie.
I want to say yes,
it's like
I don't know.
A third to a half of a good movie, and then the rest is bad. Like, thoroughly awful. But the restaurant scene alone is worth the price of admission, in my opinion. It's very Los Angeles.
Maybe we should just watch a bunch of L.A. movies. That's another potential theme. Although they could get insufferable really fast.
Real fast. A lot of L.A. movies that are real bad. And I don't think you want to watch L.A. Story. Because like I said, predominantly not good. Also not aged well, but for different reasons. And we will revisit this, and we'll be watching something else very soon. So...
stay tuned for the sequel to
whatever this is.
Defocus 236. My God.
No, that's not the number.
That's what it says on the calendar. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, it is? Oh.
I wouldn't just say it all willy-nilly. I'm looking. Unless you typed it in wrong.
No, I didn't type it in wrong. I typed it in right. I only do right things.
We're so good at this.